From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. We're going to hear now about steel, or more precisely, about the legacy of steel here in the U.S. Gary, Indiana, once a thriving steel town, is still a steel town, but it's hardly thriving, and we'll hear more on Gary in a moment. First, to Pittsburgh, the place that some still call the Steel City, has reinvented itself. Its unemployment rate is nearly 2% better than the national average. Plus, it's home to 1,600 technology companies and a growing population. Dan Bobkoff of the Midwest Public Radio Collaborative Changing Gears walks us through just how Pittsburgh transformed itself.
The first thing you should know about Pittsburgh is it's serious about its football.
Anybody selling tickets?
Cleveland sucks!
On game days, it's like the whole city piles into parking lots near Heinz Field. Fans wear the Steelers logo, still based on the mark of the steel industry. But you don't hear much about steel when you talk to tailgaters.
All of our jobs are on the rise.
Yes, Pittsburgh's economy is booming.
Pittsburgh is probably one of the most livable cities around.
Meds and eds. That's the new manufacturing. Medicine and education.
That's Melissa Zabella, Kevin Clark, Dawn Bourne, and Anthony Neff. Pittsburgh has come a long way from the early post-war years when it produced half the country's steel and a lot of its soot. Joel Tarr teaches at Carnegie Mellon University.
It was so bad that you had to have the streetlights turned on at noon in downtown Pittsburgh a number of days during the winter and the fall.
That was no way to live, and the city's future was as murky as the pollution gripping it. But in this period, a surprising coalition formed to clean things up. Leaders from business, universities, nonprofits, and government joined together to create smoke controls and clean water rules. Even so, when Steve Lee came to Pittsburgh in the early 70s to go to Carnegie Mellon, steel production was still taking a toll.
And I'd come to school at the end of summer vacation, and for 2 weeks my eyes would run, I'd have a sore throat just from all the junk that was in the air.
Lee eventually became enamored with this steel town. Today, he's the head of that architecture department where he was once a student, and he remembers those late nights studying in the 70s when he'd look out his window.
The sky was just throbbing in red as the open hearth furnaces were being stoked, and this is an amazing place. But I was very young. I didn't realize we were at a moment of an huge transformation.
Now, U.S. Steel, for its part, says it will go ahead with plans to shut that mill on April the 1st. 790 people will lose their jobs.
By the early 80s, the steel era came to an abrupt end. This was not some long, drawn-out decline like the auto industry. Virtually overnight, 150,000 manufacturing jobs were wiped out. Many blamed deregulation and foreign competition.
The closing of the mill hits much more than just the 1,200 workers inside.
I never have ever badmouthed U.S. Steel. They paid me for every minute I worked.
Colin McNeely was one of those forced to reinvent himself.
I know a lot of people today take the position that they weren't treated right. Well, suck it up and move on. That's what you have to do.
McNeely went to college and law school in his 40s. Education played a role in the city's reinvention, too. Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh became powerhouses in computing, robotics, and biotechnology. Companies were spun off, and as Steve Lee shows me on a driving tour, these sectors started replacing steel.
There's Sunoco Aristech Research Facility.
A former mill on the river is now a bustling technology park. In recent years, that coalition of groups that helped clean up Pittsburgh in the 50s used those established relationships to make projects like this happen.
So the building site is fully occupied.
Of course, not everyone has benefited from Pittsburgh's turnaround. There are still poor neighborhoods and racial divisions. But it's a long way from the general despair of the 80s. Today, no one thing dominates Pittsburgh's economy. At a church turned into a brew pub, you now find people like Rob Meyer, who started a company that will text your cell phone when a table is ready at a restaurant. Meyer is from San Francisco, but stayed in Pittsburgh after attending Carnegie Mellon.
But I kind of started liking Pittsburgh. It has a small town feel, but it's kind of a big city. And I thought it was actually a really good place to start a technology business.
One quick announcement before we get started.
This transformation is still very new, as White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs learned as he announced Pittsburgh as the site of last year's G20 summit. It was a time to showcase the city's progress to the world. But he couldn't get any respect for the place.
In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Get a little murmur there.
But Pittsburgh residents aren't laughing. There's a strong proactive movement there. This is a city that doesn't wait for things to happen anymore. And that's why other cities trying to emerge from their industrial past now look to Pittsburgh with envy. For NPR News, I'm Dan Bobkoff.
Let's come back now to the United States, to rural America, where the populations of many towns are declining, which means the school populations in many towns are declining, which means some small towns have had to close their schools and bus kids long distances. But some remote communities have come up with a new idea to keep their schools open. They are recruiting new students, international students, to help fill the empty classrooms. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports.
35 kids are crowded around tables, talking and laughing. It looks like one of those big, overstuffed classrooms that we all complain about. But it turns out this isn't one class or even one grade. This is Newcomb, New York's entire high school and middle school combined.
You know, I'm the first to admit we're very underutilized. The only thing we are lacking in our building is students.
That's Skip Holtz, Newcomb's superintendent. His school sits in a remote valley in the Adirondacks. The mine here closed in the 1970s, and the town has been shrinking steadily ever since. The school district cut staff and merged whole grades. Then 4 years ago, with enrollment still dropping, Holtz thought, why not bring in students from overseas? He started advertising the school the way you might market a high-dollar American prep school.
When I saw Newcomen, I just didn't know if I would be able to have friends, real friends here.
Manon Vernet is a stylish-looking 18-year-old from Lille, France, a city with more than a million people. She says she wanted to learn English and live in America, and the price tag for studying in Newcomb was a bargain, just $7,000 a year, room and board included. But she had no idea just how small and remote this village would be.
I start to cry.
Were you lonely?
At first, yeah, but it's okay now. It's really different, but it's like a big family, so that's why I like to be here.
This year, there are 9 foreign students from as far away as Russia and Vietnam enrolled in Newcomb.
When they arrive, it's like culture shock.
Linda Montaigne is director of the program, working with the kids and with the host families who house them in exchange for a small stipend.
Because they think New York, and of course when they think New York, they think the city, and this is nothing like it.
Cell phones don't work here because of the mountains. For many of these kids, giving up texting and instant messaging with their friends back home is sort of like being stranded on a desert island. But Montaigne says they adapt fast, going to school dances, playing on the basketball and softball teams, learning to ski and snowshoe.
But by the time they leave, it's family, and there are many tears shed. Many of them have come back, and many intend to come back yet again.
So far, the program has boosted the high school's enrollment by 25%. It's also made Newcomb sort of cosmopolitan. Caitlin Yandon is 13 years old and has lived here her entire life. Before the foreign students arrived, she says this small town could be really claustrophobic.
There's a certain way that everything is right because it's such a small school and everyone's pretty much the same.
Not anymore. These days, in science classes like this one, you'll find local kids like Caitlin working side by side with students from Moscow and Paris. 17-year-old Ang Pham from Hanoi says studying here is a stepping stone to an American college and a good career.
I already prepared my application to send to Adelphi and Clarkson University.
The school helps with special tutors and college counseling, as well as English language training. When these foreign students move on, Newcomb Town Supervisor George Cannon says he hopes they'll be replaced by an even bigger class of international recruits.
To lose a school is to lose your identity as a town, and we would fight to hold that no matter what.
Newcomb plans to open a new dormitory next year. A public school in Millinocket, Maine, is working to develop a similar program, hoping to recruit students from China. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Obama meets 20 leading business executives today. They will talk over the economy and what to do about it.
The president's relations with business have drawn much criticism. He's been attacked as hostile to business, yet also attacked for supporting business subsidies and bailouts.
Today's meeting comes as the president sells a tax deal that would affect businesses again. Last week's agreement with Republicans includes tax credits meant to encourage investment by the same kind of executives at the White House today. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Given the president's sometimes rocky relations with the business community, there's a little extra excitement whenever he sits down with a group of CEOs. But don't hold your breath. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs insists this is not a summit meeting.
Summits generally happen in Iceland and involve trench coats and nice hats.
Instead, Gibbs describes today's session as a working group, an opportunity for the president to get some feedback on his economic agenda from the heads of PepsiCo, Google, GE, and others.
The president wants to hear from them about what they see in the road ahead for the economy and ideas that they have on continuing our economic recovery.
Mr. Obama hopes the tax cut deal will accelerate that recovery. One element, which he's been pushing for months, would allow companies to write off the full value of any business investment on their taxes next year, rather than spreading the deduction over several years the way they usually do. Economist Nigel Gault of IHS Global Insight says that will give companies a modest incentive to invest now rather than later.
At the margin it helps. Is it going to be the primary mover driving business investment next year? Probably not.
The deal includes other business-friendly measures, including a renewed tax credit for research and development and a $5 billion extension of tax breaks for ethanol. That ethanol break is popular with corn producers in Iowa, but not with critics in Congress, like Republican Senator John McCain.
Call these ethanol favors the Hawkeye handouts. That's what this bill is all about. And I say to my colleagues, I'll vote for it, but it's not what the people said they wanted done on November 2nd.
But despite a few such special favors, polls show the overall tax cut deal is popular with voters. It extends Bush-era tax cuts for everyone, including the wealthy, and provides a one-year reduction in the payroll tax that workers contribute to Social Security. That payroll tax cut, along with an extension of unemployment benefits, will put an extra $160 billion into people's pockets over the next year. Assuming that money doesn't all stay in their pockets, we should see consumers spending more. That would be welcome news to Dorothy Coleman, Vice President of the National Association of Manufacturers.
Everyone would like demand to increase. That would be a sign of economic growth. So some of the provisions in there, the lower tax rates, are going to help consumer demand.
Ultimately, it's that stepped-up demand for products and services, more than any tax break, that will drive companies to invest in their businesses and hire more workers. U.S. businesses are sitting on nearly $2 trillion in cash right now, a historically high amount. Economist Gault expects the president to encourage some of the CEOs he's meeting with today to put more of their cash to work sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. What he'd love to see would be a surge in business confidence, which will undo those purse strings.
And there are signs big business is feeling more confident. 80% of big company CEOs surveyed by the Business Roundtable say they expect to increase sales in the next 6 months, and 45% expect to increase hiring. Both figures represent an improvement from 3 months ago. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says all the government can do is try to help.
We are not going to see a sustained economic recovery until we see that it is sparked and led by the private sector.
So the president, who's sometimes been perceived as a scold for big business, will today be serving as cheerleader-in-chief. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Mike Puente at the main entrance of U.S. Steel's Gary Works in Gary, Indiana. This is a gritty Midwest town that is trying to embrace some of Pittsburgh's lessons, but is still very much involved in making steel. Jim Robinson says Gary's dependence on steel isn't likely to change anytime soon.
Gary's future is obviously not ever going to be decoupled from U.S. Steel simply because it's a major part of the city and a major part of the city's tax base.
Robinson started his career in steel more than 40 years ago. Back then, finding a job at a local steel mill was easy as pie.
Used to be you could walk up to the employment office and they'd try and talk you into starting in the afternoon. Certainly not true today.
Robinson should know he heads the district office in Gary for the United Steelworkers of America. He's seen jobs at U.S. Steel's Gary Works dwindle from 50,000 in the 1960s to just over 6,000 today. Robinson says the huge mill still produces 7 million tons of raw steel each year, about the same as it used to, but with far fewer workers. While Gary tries to attract new industries, moving toward fields such as education and medicine, like in Pittsburgh, may be difficult here because there's not much of a base to build on. But there are some signs that Gary is trying to follow Pittsburgh's lead. A Chicago firm wants to build a $100 million data storage facility on an empty lot here. Ben Clement, whose job is to attract new development to Gary, helped lure the company.
We definitely want to continue to embrace our industrial past. However, from a business perspective, we have to recognize that attracting or luring clean industries and high technology is going to be important for Gary's growth and our future.
Dean Kaplan heads Public Financial Management of Philadelphia and is working with Gary on its budget shortfall. Kaplan says while this city has assets to exploit, it needs to shift its thinking.
You're talking about making a major sea change in how places are perceived and really leveraging their assets in a way that may not have been done in a long time.
Rudy Clay is mayor of Gary. He says the city is committed to diversifying its economic base and is trying to expand its underused airport. It also wants to expand its own local college, Indiana University Northwest, and increase tourism. One way to do that is to honor its most famous former resident. That's right. Michael Jackson was born in Gary in 1958 and lived here until he was 10 years old. But Mayor Clay still sees U.S. Steel as this city's anchor, and he's not too worried it will pull up anytime soon.
No, they're not going anywhere. I think we're going to continue to be good cooperative partners with U.S. Steel. They will be here.
Of course, steelworkers in Pittsburgh said the same thing 3 decades ago. But after all, when Gary was founded in 1906, it couldn't link its future to U.S. Steel any more closely. It named itself after the company's first chairman, Albert H. Gary. For NPR News, I'm Michael Puente.